Welcome to Done and Done. I'm Alicia, your hostess on this podcast journey, all things Dominic Dunn, who our man Nick is going to wrap around in this episode as Truman Capote gets his big black and white ball idea from Dominic and Lenny Dunn, who do it 2.5 years before. We have covered both Truman Capote's and the Dunn's black and white balls in their own episodes. See episode 14 of Done and Done or episode 117, respectively. Today, we are deep diving as we continue to swim with the swans about Truman's 1966 ball. This is our second main feed episode this week. All of the hot gossip that was not the black and white ball is in the previous episode. Today, it's all about the black and white ball. Every bit of it. The before, the during, the after. Before we begin today's episode, I do have a number of thanks to give so many good folks out there. First up, big thanks, love, praise to our newest supporters over on Patreon. Thank you so much. Big love to Meryl B., Spencer P., Wilhelmine W., Bailey M., Jennifer R., Amanda B., and Jen. Also, big thanks to a few other Patreon folks. Everybody who came out to our first Friday Salon last week on Patreon. Thank you, Cindy and Sarah and Whitney and Heather and Nicola. Holy cats, it was so good to see and hang out with y'all. So grateful to our new and sustaining Patreon supporters. If you are looking to get a bit more out of your own Done and Done investigation, patreon.com/doneanddone is the place to go to find out information about getting your very own feed of ad-free and early episodes, bonus not done yet episodes too. Many thanks to our Patreon folks. Many thanks to you for joining us today. Let's have some fun. The black and white ball. What does everyone have to say about it in real life and in real time? So much commentary, so many stories coming from all directions. We have the before the ball stories, the at the ball stories, and the after the ball stories too. Let's investigate. Oh, do you remember November 1966 and Truman's black and white ball? I am going to be taking these recollections today from George Plimpton's Truman Capote, in which various friends, enemies, acquaintances, and detractors recall his turbulent career. As you can imagine, within this particular book, there is a great deal of information dedicated to Truman's black and white ball. Settle in, friends, this one's going to go long, but it sure does connect. Interestingly, there's not a lot from Truman Capote about his own black and white ball. His own personal letters go dark from the summer of 1966 to the following year. Truman Capote, the prolific letter writer, nothing after the black and white ball for a good year, year and a half. Again, for feud, Capote versus the Swans, hats off to the design team. The Plaza Hotel's grand ballroom in Manhattan was the actual location of Truman's ball and the filming of this scene in the show. Pretty authentic there, but wowza, the set really was beautiful. I'm taking this bit very quickly from Elle Decor about the Plaza. Simply known as the Plaza, the 18-story chateau-style building was completed and opened in 1907 and has remained an icon of New York City for the past 117 years. And all of the historic moments for the hotel, the most memorable occurred in its grand ballroom on the evening of November 28, 1966, when Capote hosted his famous black and white ball in honor of Katharine Graham, publisher of the Washington Post. It was probably one of our easier sets because it was famously sort of lacking in decoration, says Ricker, of the red tablecloths and gold candelabras his team laid throughout the already opulent space. Whether it was Truman or Babe's idea, they decided that all the guests in masks and costumes would be the decoration. While we can only speculate what Ricker's production team spent to recreate the masquerade ball, Capote was only out $16,000, or about $150,000 today. What decor was there at the actual ball, we replicated, Ricker explains. There was a specificity that those who know the ball will find. In order to get to the night of the ball, we have to plan for the ball. Balls just don't happen by themselves. Let's talk about the before the ball comments. We're going to open here with John Knowles. I think this is very fitting. Don't you think Truman sat there in Monroeville, Alabama, when he was about 10, deeply rejected and out of it, strange little outcast even in his own house, and said that someday he would hire the most beautiful ballroom in New York City and he would have the most elegant and famous people in the world there? This next one up is from Catherine Graham, publisher of the Washington Post. Truman called me up that summer and said, "I think you need cheering up, and I'm going to give you a ball." "Well," I said, "I don't need cheering up, and what are you talking about?" I was totally baffled. He said, "Yes, yes, I've always had this idea for a black and white ball." He told me that he'd always loved the black and white scene at the racetrack in My Fair Lady. Also, he said that he loved the ballroom in the plaza and always wanted to have a party there. I was still sort of baffled, but then he got rolling with it and the publicity got started. I felt a little bit that Truman was going to give the ball anyway and that I was part of the props. Perhaps a prop is unfair, but I felt that he needed a guest of honor, and with a lot of imagination, he figured out me. We have covered Catherine Graham's story in a previous episode in Capote's Coterie. That little bit where Truman says he loved the black and white scene at the racetrack in My Fair Lady, he sure did. Somebody gave that ball before him based on that scene. Let's continue. Phyllis Cerf Wagner has this to say. "I first learned he was going to do it sitting around the pool. He'd been dreaming about it for a long time. The plaza was his place, as you know, his security blanket. Before his books came out, he and I had become really instant friends, and we would go to the plaza to have lunch there. In the beginning, the only place he felt secure enough to go to. Eventually, he spread out to Voisin, Lecote Basque, and so forth. But earlier, the plaza was the place that was elegant and classy enough for him. I would guess that's why he decided to have the ball there." Ashton Hawkins, a museum executive, has this to say. "Truman recognized that she, Catherine Graham, was a powerful woman who really didn't know anything about the big world outside of Washington in those days. She hadn't pursued it or expected to. He chose her as his guest of honor and got all these people together. She was kind of shy about it, unused to the attention and not that comfortable with it. She didn't seek it out, and she was quite pleased that somebody would do it for her." Catherine Graham's husband had passed away. Previous to this ball, Catherine and Truman had also spent quite a delightful little bit of time on hashish on the Agnelli's yacht, in a little piece that Truman will immortalize called Yachts and Things. Yachts and Things is a chapter from Answered Prayers. We have covered that over on Patreon. I'm not done yet. So many connections. Poor Catherine Graham. She did not seek it out. She did not want the party. She, I think, was a little bit pleased by the party, but let's be honest, Truman threw the party for himself. We're going to get there. Eleanor Freed has this to say. "At the beginning of that summer in Bridgehampton, I was kind of a zombie. My husband, Donald, had died suddenly on Memorial Day. That summer, 1965, Truman would come every day and sit by the pool. This may be fantasy because I was in a very strange state, but I thought he was inventing the ball to keep me going. He came every single day to the pool with a guest list he was working on. For a time, I just couldn't believe it. I'm not going to invite the Lyndon Johnsons. Those Secret Service men are so boring. Maybe just Linda Bird. Even when I realized it wasn't a fantasy, it was all quite magical. I don't think I could have gotten through the summer without him. I want to pull back that summer 1965 that Truman begins planning his ball. The In Cold Blood murderers had been executed back in April. Truman was working on finalizing In Cold Blood, the final chapters, getting ready to publish, probably ready for a little bit of fun, a little bit of different for how his last 6 years had been spent. Leo Lerman has this to say, "The ball was one of his major works, as much a major work as some of his short stories. He sat there planning it all summer long. I came back from somewhere to find him surrounded by these notebooks. I wondered, what work is he writing? It turned out to be this ball." One of the things he adored saying was, "Well, maybe you'll be invited and maybe you won't." He'd say things like, "Well, we're going to have so-and-so." Then he'd make little notes. He had the most marvelous time doing it. It was his reward for all those years he kept to himself. It was ostensibly for K. Graham. It was for Truman. Let's hear from our man, Nick. You know he wasn't going to stay silent in this. Dominic Dunn has this to say. 2 years before Truman's ball, on my 10th wedding anniversary, my wife Lenny and I gave a black and white ball where the ladies were asked to dress in black and white. We had a policy that no one could bring house guests or anything because there was just limited space. At the last minute, Truman called and said, yes, I'm coming. I'm going to be there, but I'm bringing 3 guests. Well, we didn't have the nerve to say to him, well, you can't bring them. They turned out to be Alvin Dewey, the FBI agent, his wife, and a third person involved in the In Cold Blood case. It was a very glamorous affair filled with film stars. These people from that little town in Kansas were absolutely awed by it. I mean, David Niven, Gina Lollobrigida, Natalie Wood, Loretta Young, Jennifer Jones. I mean, it went on and on. That was 1964, the days when Hollywood was still the kind of Hollywood we fantasize about. We had our house totally cleared of furniture. And off the library in the back, there was a tent so huge that friends who had been coming to our house for years were disoriented. They didn't know where they were. We had 2 bands. It was very beautiful, an extravagant waste of money. I mean, later in life, when I went broke, I think that was a perfect example of why. Truman loved it. I have these incredible photographs of him dancing with Tuesday Weld, talking to Jennifer Jones. He was one of the last ones to leave. Then, 2 years later, he gave his great ball, the black and white ball, did the same thing, but he didn't invite us. If you are a longtime Dunn & Dunn listener, you know that Dominic and Lenny Dunn were friends also with Cecil Beaton. They were entertaining Cecil Beaton, loved that scene, his scene in My Fair Lady so much, with all the black and white costuming. The Dunns had the idea first. What do they say? Steal like an artist? Truman certainly did. A little bit of a hint coming for you. The Dunns did not get invited to Truman's ball, but Dunn's arch nemesis at that time, Frank Sinatra, and his new wife, Mia Farrow, did. Oh, y'all, it's so interesting to me. Truman's people are Dominic Dunn's people. All of these people are very much in the same set. This episode really is where some of these names come together in just a galaxy, a vortex of spiderwebs. I love it so much. Okay, let's move on to George Plimpton. What does George Plimpton have to say about the before the ball? Truman must have kept at his guest list all that summer, pruning, adding, mostly pruning, I suspect. I remember one summer day at the Bennett Serfs in Mount Kisco, the estate they called the Columns because the money to build it had come from the proceeds Bennett got for his syndicated columns, Tradewinds Surfboard among them. It was a hot day, and I remember the luncheon guests gathered around the swimming pool that afternoon. Frank Sinatra, Mia, his young wife then, and Truman, of course. Mia, in a black bathing suit, as I remember, was lying on her back in the sun by the edge of the pool, just enchanting, and not really part of the conversation or anything, when suddenly a butterfly landed on the exposed part of her breast, just above the line of the bathing suit. It was one of the large swallowtail variety, the kind that fans its wings absolutely straight up and holds them there motionless, a sail for an instant, and then fans them again. Absolutely beautiful, of course, obviously because it had picked Mia to land on, fawn-like, childlike, and we all stared spellbound. Then Truman broke it, quite abruptly. "What about the Getzes?" he called out quite loudly, or some such name. "Should I invite them or co-sign them?" Shauna Alexander, a writer, had this to say. "I had just gotten divorced in California and was in New York having dinner at the Lafayette restaurant with David Merrick. David said, 'I'm going to a party called the Black and White Ball and you're not invited, so you can't come.' Truman is giving it. He's hired squads of security men to keep out the crashers." David didn't know that Truman and I were old friends, or that I happened to notice that at the next table a piece of paper was curled in a glass that read Capote. By chance, Truman's table was reserved right at the next banquette. So I thought I'd be clever. I went into the ladies' room and wrote on my card, "Have black and white dress and suitcase, just hit town." Because I lived in California, I thought if I stuck it in Truman's pocket unobtrusively, if he didn't invite me, if Merrick was right, it wouldn't be embarrassing. He would simply find this card in his pocket from an old friend. He came and sat down. To make himself look slim, he had on one of those Morty Sills suits with no pockets, but I didn't know that. I kept trying to find a pocket to slip my card into. He finally asked, "What the hell are you doing to me?" "I was trying to put this card in your pocket," I said. He looked at it and said, "Of course you can come to my party. I'd love to have you come to my party." Merrick, well, his balloon was punctured, but mine was blown up. From Tommy Phipps, another writer. He'd call us up and talk about it. I distinctly remember him talking about the people who thought they were being terribly cunning by saying, "What are you doing Monday the 28th? Knowing full well that he was knee-deep in the plaza, that old trick. It worked many, many times, but not with Truman. R. Court Hay says, "Truman always claimed he invited 500 of his friends and made 15,000 enemies." Peter Duchin, oh goodness, is going to play for Truman's Black and White Ball. Peter Duchin, so very much connected into all of this story. Let's see about what he, orchestra leader, has to say. "We'd been asked by Truman to play at his ball, obviously a private affair. He said to me, 'Please don't tell anybody.' Of course, everybody knew instantly because there was an awful lot of talk about the ball before it was given. One day, I got a call in my office from Earl Wilson, the columnist. Earl said to me, 'Gee, Peter, I hear you're playing Truman Capote's Black and White Ball.' I said, 'Yes.' He said, 'Well, you know, they're not allowing the press in at all.' I said, 'Earl, that is unfortunate and what a shame.' Well, he said, 'You know, there's this wonderful thing I once did.' I can't remember if he'd done it or someone else, which is that he'd snuck into the White House during Roosevelt's administration as a fiddle player. He said, 'I wonder if you'd consider letting me sneak into the party as one of your trombonists.' I said, 'Let me think about it, Earl.' So I thought about it, and I thought it wouldn't be a terribly good idea. I do remember the way Earl Wilson looked, short and bulbous, and that a trombone would have been a suitable instrument." Eleanor Freed says, Truman was absolutely terrible about his guest list. If he liked the husband and didn't like the wife, he'd invite the husband. He wanted lots of single men. Ken McCormick was dating Ann Hutchins, whom he later married, but Truman was insistent. Absolutely not. He was ruthless. James Merrill has this to say. I hadn't been asked, which was perfectly all right with me. It's not my idea of the best way to spend an evening. But whom it mattered to tremendously was Grace Stone, the novelist. She and her daughter, Eleanor Perigny, were Truman's great friends in Stonington, though Truman had mixed feelings about Grace. We went out to Brooklyn one night for dinner after he'd had his Stonington summer. He'd hoped just David and I would come, but we said, oh, Grace is in town. Wouldn't you like her to come along? So he said, sure. Truman's apartment had this room that had been multifariously reupholstered. He brought back all these swatches of silk from the Orient, and every cushion was done in a different one. He'd taken the bolts of cloth to an upholsterer and said, do what you can. There were too many cushions for a van to carry out to Brooklyn. There were a couple of rather nice armchairs upholstered in yellow brocade. Anyhow, we went to the kitchen for dinner and somebody smelled something burning. Grace's cigarette had landed in an armchair. Truman was very gentlemanly about it. Oh, it doesn't matter. Don't be silly. But after dinner, he put on the records and wanted to dance. I was dancing with Truman. That old bitch, I didn't want her here anyway. Very cross about his armchair. So, she wasn't on the party list. I think she ought to have been. I think he thought she ought to have been, too, because people he had met through her, like the Lionel Trillings, were invited. She was an old friend and had known him from the days of his first success. So when she wasn't on the invitation list, she could not resist writing him a note. Truman, I didn't think you were the kind of person who climbed atop corpses of your former friends. As it happens, I shall not be in this country when you give your affair. I'm flying to Rome the day before, and I won't have been there, but I do think you might have invited me. Well, I saw the letter that she got back. It was on a loose-leaf-lined pad with his little handwriting. Gee, I wish you'd spared yourself writing me this cruel letter. Of course an invitation was sent to you, to East 79th Street. Of course I expect you. Please let me know whether you will come and the name of your escort. Handling it very nicely. But Grace had already cut off her nose, as it were, and couldn't have gone to the party without the stitches showing. She left for Europe that day or the day before. She might have changed her plans. We talked about it. I said, Grace, you can't. Not now. Bob Colicello, the writer, says Truman did invite Andy Warhol to the black and white ball, but he couldn't bring anyone, which for Andy in the 60s was a major agony. We are going to talk about Andy Warhol coming up in a future episode. Jane Howard, the writer, says, it was much more fun to get ready for the black and white ball than it was to go. It was actually kind of a letdown. I remember being annoyed because he gave me to understand that I should not bring somebody. I was kind of miffed. The guy I was seeing then took pictures of me getting ready, and then I was off and I thought, gee, without him, why can't he come too? Marissa Berenson, model and actress, said this, Halston was a close friend at that time. He did my mask and my dress, the whole outfit where I was supposed to come as a rabbit. I had a long black velvet dress, ears, and a rabbit face. Then I missed a fitting, and he thought I wasn't going to go, so he gave the dress to Amanda Burden. We have talked a lot about Amanda Burden. You've heard her name. Just to connect Amanda Burden for you, Amanda is Bill and Babe Paley's daughter. Halston gives the rabbit dress to Amanda Burden. Continuing from Marissa, I was absolutely devastated. At the last minute, he had to make me something completely new. I wore a turban. I turned from a rabbit into an Indian princess, extremely exotic. Halston always did wonderful things. This is from Denise Boucher, a friend. I looked pretty silly. At Kenneth's, I had my hair dyed black on one side and powdered white on the other. Talk about a skunk. I wore it sort of like Madame Pompadour. Then I had a mask left over from the masked ball for Sheila Rochambeau that her father, the Duke de Talleyrand, gave for her just outside Paris, where we all wore opera capes. Saint Laurent did it for me. Little black sparkles in it, cat's eyes with a little red in the corners. For Truman's, it went perfectly with the black and white crepe evening dress I already had from Simonetta or Princess Mary Etta or Galisi, I forget which. So I didn't have to do much except for my hair, which was my idea. At Kenneth's, they're never surprised by what I ask for. I was rather embarrassed to find myself sitting next to Kay Graham with my hair going black and white while she seemed to be having a fairly simple hairdo. Now's a great time to bring up Kenneth Salon. Kenneth Battelle was the hairdresser of the time. This again comes from eldecor.com. The Kenneth Salon location was filmed at the Women's National Republican Club in Manhattan. From El Decor, just a little bit about Kenneth Battelle. He was widely considered the first celebrity hairdresser and became as legendary as the Beaumont Bouffant hairdos he set atop the heads of Jacqueline Kennedy, Babe Paley, and Brooke Astor. His eponymous salon opened in 1963 at 19 East 54th Street, inside an Italian Renaissance revival-style palazzo between Madison and Fifth that was designed by none other than Billy Baldwin. The interior decorator mixed untold yards of floral and paisley cotton fabrics, installed lacquered bamboo chairs and mirrors at stylized workstations, and even set a potted palm tree at the center of a divan de milieu, a large circular ottoman, for added drama. While Ricker's team didn't take all of the available references literally, the salon set makes a memorable impact. We recreated it to a degree, he adds, and it really comes off well in the show. When you hear Kenneth associated with hair, Kenneth Battelle is who we're thinking of. Kenneth is his salon. Kay Graham has this to say. I'd been over there the week before and had my hair done on the second floor. This woman, Murray, was at the top of the stairs, and she said, "We're all so busy preparing for the ball." It was sort of like Cinderella. I said, "Well, the ball's being thrown for me." She said, "It's being thrown for you?" She said, "Well, who's doing your hair?" And I said, "I don't know, Jonathan somebody." And she said, "Well, Kenneth has to do your hair," which he did after he put thousands of ringlets in Marissa Berenson's hair. It's not just hair that all the fancies were delighted by. Aldolfo is another designer. He has this to say. Some of the orders for masks came in many weeks before the ball. I would be shown the design of the dress and then suggest what the mask would look like to go well with the dress or the jewelry. A blue sapphire. Oh, we did many, many for Drew Hines, Adele Astaire, Merle Oberon, Amanda Burden, Betsy Bloomingdale. Hers I remember best, a very delicate one, made in the shape of a butterfly and held up on a stick. All of them had sticks, sometimes in the middle, sometimes on the side. A mask that fits the face disturbs the makeup and so on when you take it off, so they all had little sticks to hold. We were very busy. I was invited to the ball, but I don't think I'd do very well at such things. So Truman came in later and told me all about it. Peter Matheson, another writer, says, Truman was kind of upset when I told him my book was going well and I didn't want to break off to go to his black and white party. I explained that I would only get drunk and lose the drift of things for 2 or 3 days, but he was utterly unmollified. He was even more annoyed when Bill Styron stayed home too for the same reason. Bill had rung up to ask if I was going to Truman's party, and when I said no, he said, "Great, I'm not going either. As it turned out, we missed something wonderful, and Bill upbraids me every few years. You talked us out of the best party in history. Next time I saw Truman, he was still a little sulky. When I asked if I was forgiven, he burst out, Cecil Beaton came all the way from London for my party and you wouldn't even come in from Sagaponack. George Page, television executive, has this to say. When I was in Vietnam, I began to get calls from Truman who had figured out how to call me there, a rather amazing feat in and of itself, and he told me about this party that from the outset he began to talk about as the party of the century, and how I absolutely must come. I would say, Truman, there is no way I can come all the way from Saigon to New York. Having since learned that people were absolutely fighting and would kill for invitations to that party, I've concluded I must be just about the only one who declined Truman's kind invitation. Maria Teresa Kane, literary agent, says this, I flew from San Francisco to New York carrying my mask. Literally everyone, porters at the airport, cab drivers, strangers, it seemed like all of New York knew about the party. I couldn't put my mask in my bag. It would have been all squashed and ruined. It was on a stick, covered in cellophane, and everyone knew I was going to Truman's ball. They'd say, oh, you're going to Truman's party. Not to Capote's party, but to Truman's party. It was so intimate. For a while, it looked like I was going to Truman's ball with a bath towel and the mask because the airline lost my bag with my dress. It finally arrived at the hotel 2 hours before the ball. In the meantime, Geraldine Stutt sent over something I could wear from Bendel's in case my dress didn't arrive. Then there was great excitement in the hotel. The maids would come running and say, oh, your dress is here, your dress is here. Herb Kane said, it was the talk of New York. The elevator operators, the taxi cab drivers, the doormen. As soon as they saw you with a mask or a headdress, they'd say, going to Truman's ball, huh? New York had that funny small town feel to it. They were all excited that you were going to the ball. That part was fun. It was like the Super Bowl. There was such a buildup that by the time the game was played, it didn't amount to much. One last comment about the before the ball time, this one from Phyllis Surf Wagner. I guess we were all glad to be there. That's the name of the game. If you hadn't been invited, you would have been terribly hurt. It was a good party as parties go. I mean, certainly the world was there, and you wouldn't have wanted to be left out of the world. So, there we were. And that is the lead up to Truman's little party. We're going to take a quick break, hear from a few sponsors. When we return, we are going to talk about the actual night. What happened, how it all went down, what were the people who were there thinking and seeing and doing. And we're back, investigators. Let's find out what happened at Truman's Black and White Ball for real. We've made it to November 28th, 1966. It's a Monday night. It's very rainy. Peter Duchin is going to be headlining our orchestra. Peter Duchin was requested to feature Cole Porter's music in particular, with the rest of the music being supplied by Gershwin, Rogers, and Kern. We're going to begin this night hearing from Joel Schumacher, the film director. There were dinner parties before the ball. Afterward, buses with manned bars and champagne took everyone to the plaza. So who was invited to whose party was very important. It was not enough to go to the ball. You also had to go to one of these five or six major parties that took place before the ball. Hosts and hostesses, as I remember, were extremely nervous. They had given their word to Truman that they would be on time for the ball. They had to make sure their parties didn't last too long. There was a wonderful man who worked at Vogue, the Baron Nicholas de Gunsberg, one of the taste arbiters. The hostess of the dinner he was going to was so nervous about being late, she kept calling him, saying, "Now we promised Truman we won't be late." He was very droll. He had this little cigarette he was smoking. This was about 2 days before the party. He said, "Well, why don't we all just get dressed and go now? We won't be late." Petey Lumet, wife of Sydney, has this to say. "We gave one of the dinners before the ball. We had the writers. Norman Mailer sat next to me. He said, you ought to be an elevator operator. You just go up and down. I don't even want to think about what he meant by that." From Norman Mailer, "I met Pat Lawford at dinner before the ball." This would be Patricia Lawford Kennedy. "Petey Lumet gave the dinner. Lawford and I were seated next to each other. We got along like a house of fire because we did nothing but insult each other all night. It was wonderful. She said, I don't know why I'm sitting next to you. I heard you're awful. Or some extraordinary thing. I said, well, that just shows how dumb the people are that you know. We've gotten along ever since." The economist John Kenneth Galbraith had this to say. "Kitty and I went down to New York and went to Jean Stein's dinner beforehand, where I sat next to Alice Longworth. A few days before, Jonathan Daniels's memoir about Franklin Roosevelt had just been published, which for the first time gave wide recognition to the existence of Lucy Mercer. So I immediately asked her, Alice, about that and got a marvelous Longworth response, which I don't think has ever been repeated. Absolutely nothing to it. Everybody knows that Franklin was paralyzed from the waist down." Mary Lazar, wife of Swifty Lazar, who we have covered in our investigation, had this to say. "Donald Brooks had designed me an enormous and very funny headpiece. Enormous. It looked like something Josephine would have worn if Irving had gone as Napoleon. Black velvet, net, and things. It was so large I couldn't get in the car after the dinner with it because it was too high. We had the Rolls Royce in New York at that time. We took Lauren Bacall and other people to the plaza. The car had a nervous breakdown that night. The weather was so cold and damp, a slight rain. It broke down in front of the plaza, so that was lucky. It wasn't used to the weather. It froze." From Mia Farrow, actress and new wife of Frank Sinatra at the time. "I remember the great excitement, the throng of press at the door of the plaza, and all the beautiful gowns. But I didn't know who Katharine Graham was, and in fact, I didn't know who anybody was." Katharine Graham says this, "Truman and I had drinks with the Paleys, and then we went off to a room upstairs in the plaza and had a box dinner, which I'd ordered from 21. Then about 10, we went down to stand in the receiving line." John Knowles says, "I thought the masked ball was a hoot. I felt as though we were in Versailles in 1788. People were applauding us in the street as we walked in. We had our masks on. I thought next year it'll be the tumbrils taking us to Herald Square, but at the moment, we were the last of the aristocrats. I remember arriving at the side entrance of the plaza. There was a solid phalanx of news media. I forgot exactly what group I was with, but no stars were with us. We arrived and the Klieg lights went on because we were masked. They turned on the lights and looked at us. Nobody. The lights went off again." I'm excited about this next participant in our story, Eileen Mailey. Eileen Mailey, y'all know. You may not know her real name, Eileen Mailey, but you would know her gossip columnist name, Susie Knickerbocker. Eileen Mailey, we've used a lot of comments from in this series. I'm really excited for our folks on Patreon. Our Not Done Yet episode this week is about Eileen Mailey, infamous Gossip Society columnist for over 5 decades. Eileen has this to say. "With most parties, you can tell when you walk in the door, this is going to go. I mean, everything from a little dinner party of 16 people to a huge ball for 1,000 people. You go in and you know how this is going to go. Or you go in and you say to yourself, no. When I came in at the start of the party, Truman said, darling, the way he always said, darling, stay close by us and that way you can see everybody as they come in. He thought that would be an excellent vantage point for me. and he wanted me to see the guests, of course, because he knew I was going to write about it all. It was the most dazzling party that I had ever been to, so far, of course. If anyone else had given it, it really wouldn't have been that dazzling. But it was Truman, who meant so much then. It was Kay, a powerful woman, and it was the guest list. Also, it was the costumes. Everyone went all out. It was the first time I'd ever seen Penelope Tree. She looked like a forest creature, these great eyes staring out and her hair hanging straight, and I remember she was dressed as a wood nymph. Most of the costumes were superb. Oscar and Francoise de la Renta came with big furry cat heads on, one black and the other white, and they were marvelous. The mask thing was very clever of Truman. If people had come in dinner jackets and evening dresses, well, it still would have been a glamorous party, but it never would have had that extra cachet that Truman created by A, the guest list, and then B, asking them to dress like that, masked and marvelous. Jack Dunphy, Truman's lover, recalls, "I had a mask, a little thing. As soon as I came into the room, Truman was so disgusted with the way I looked, he pulled it right off and said, 'Kay, here's Jack.' The mask business was very funny. A member in my party said, 'I've lost it.' I said, 'You haven't lost it at all. You've just lost your identity. You're so confused at the idea of covering those lovely orbs of yours.' He did, and he just threw it away." Ben Bradley, editor of the Washington Post, says about the night, "There was Truman sort of beaming, and next to him Catherine, with a wonderful mixture of being proud, yet wondering whether or not this was the path down which she wished to travel. But for a moment, there she was, the belle of the ball, and wore it so nicely. I was quite moved. But then when you walked in, well, I had never quite endorsed the beautiful people because there were so many weirdos. Still, there were a lot of people in the ballroom who don't ordinarily go to such events, and therefore, it had a sort of unjaded quality." John Kenneth Galbraith again. "I didn't buy a mask. My professional dignity overwhelmed me, and also the fact that since I'm 6'8½" tall, the likelihood that I would be concealed by a mask was minimal. We made our way up the stairs to the ballroom just behind with Bill Buckley and his wife Pat, who turned and said to me, 'I'm going to choke you before the evening is over for what you said about Bill.' I'd forgotten what the hell it was I said about him. I do remember going up the stairs, facing the wrath of my tall fellow Canadian, and to be greeted at the top of the stairs by, of all people, Truman Capote and Kay Graham." Let's hear from William F. Buckley Jr. about that. "I recall meeting Ken Galbraith for the first time. It was rather extraordinary in that he took the occasion to apologize for an indiscretion he felt badly about. What had happened was that he had upbraided a distinguished economist for having written for the National Review at the time Kennedy was killed. It was an entirely emotional decision. The idea nobody that high up in academia ought to be associated with any magazine that opposed Jack Kennedy so strongly. Well, he took that occasion to apologize for having done that." From George Plimpton, "I had a mask which was glued together about one day before, and I could barely. I went staggering past Truman and Kay Graham in the receiving line. I spent most of the evening quite sick with this mask. I had gotten rather precieux and had this thing made. It hadn't been stitched together, it had been glued. When you put the thing on, it was like being in a glue factory. They say sniffing glue gives you a high, but this didn't. It made me quite nauseated. I reeled around. I took it off after a while." Jill Fox, a friend of Truman, says, "I was wearing a great boa of white ostrich feathers. I was trying to be chic, and every time I breathed, a feather would shoot up my nostrils. A photograph appeared somewhere of me being greeted by Truman. It was of a strange person I don't think I ever knew in my life, and it was myself. Very thin, strange little person, smiling brightly, and Truman was looking over my shoulder." John Barry Ryan says, I wore a very simple mask. I believe I'm the only man whose feet only have ever appeared in Women's Wear Daily. According to WWD, I was the only person at the ball who wore classic dancing pumps. That's my claim to fame. Harold Prince says, It was the last time we ever went to anything remotely like that. We were back out on the street within a half hour of arrival. Donald Brooks whipped up a feathered mask for my wife, Judy. I remember we were both rather uncomfortable about the whole thing. At the Plaza Hotel, I got a lot more uncomfortable because of the people on the street. The French Revolution came to mind, and our place in the tumbrils. Of course, the receiving line was enormously cordial. Truman was enormously nice, but we sat down, we took one look around us, and we quietly left out of discomfort. I would lie if I didn't say out of disapproval, too. But we went, didn't we? The artist Polly Kraft recalls, All of us from Washington were rather terrified, titillated, thrilled to be invited. Those swan-necked Italians were just ravishing. Morella Agnelli, just like Richard Avedon's portrait of her. So beautiful, one gasped. Babe Paley, Gloria Guinness. One was almost numb with the glamour and excitement of it all. Of course, we were all younger then. None of us had become blasé or jaded. Lowell Guinness, husband of Gloria, says that Gloria went, I did not. I do not like to see that sort of thing, wearing a mask, absolutely childish. I probably went to bed that night. Jack Dunphy, Truman's lover, has another memory. I had a good time, but I don't know that anyone else did. I've never seen such ghettoizing in all my life. No group mixed with another group. They were all scared shitless of one another. When I asked Babe Paley to dance, this old Jew who sat next to her said, Don't go away now, and started clawing all over her. When I asked Gloria Guinness to, well, they were the kind of people who would be with gentlemen who would say, Well, you know, I can't, you know. Should I wear iron pants? She was clawed, too. Not by their husbands. I don't remember seeing Bill Paley there at all. They had to return to their little table where they were surrounded by old tycoons. It was a riot. There was no mingling there. I'd just dance, that's all. I think it was the last time I ever danced. Gloria Guinness, whom I liked, said, You certainly cut a mean rug. Do you practice by yourself? I do. Gordon Parks, the photographer, says everyone was looking at each other. I got the feeling that half the people there didn't know the other half, at least as friends. Quite a lot of nervous bowing and greeting. I went with my second wife, Elizabeth. She spent a fortune getting a rhinestone mask made. We didn't eat for 2 weeks. I didn't wear a mask. With a mask, people wouldn't know that I was black. After all, I was there to make it a real black and white ball. Lenora Hornblow, the novelist, recalls, I went to the Great Ball with Arthur Hornblow Jr., the Cerfs, and the Leland Haywards, and Frank Sinatra, then married to Mia. The backers were there. George Eavy, who did Truman's apartment for him at the UN Plaza. Everything was so beautiful, all that black and white. I had my hair painted white. I couldn't believe it. I had a mask made with beautiful white feathers to go with my white hair. Sinatra wore one of those little 5 and 10 masks. I was so entertained by myself that I really had very little time for anyone else. I was very busy being photographed. Truman was very pleased to see me, really pleased because I had gone to some trouble. I couldn't wait for the next day to come so I could have this terrible liquid flower washed out of my hair. Denise Bush, we seemed to sit around a lot in chairs and corners and watch everyone. Ronnie Tree was at our table. Diana Vreeland had just made his daughter, Penelope, famous in the pages of Vogue, and she was sitting at the table, very, very thin, with her big saucer eyes and her straight hair, so devoted to her father, sitting there rather like a little calf. Monroe Wheeler, the curator, says, I remember Ronnie Tree's daughter Penelope was so beautiful. Cecil Beaton took one look at her and spent the rest of the evening dancing with her. Dear Princess, Lee Radziwill has a memory. Everyone stood back when Jerome Robbins danced with Betty Bacall. When they started out in a corner, people were dancing everywhere, but the two of them were so superb, the dance floor just cleared. Arthur Schlesinger Jr., the historian, recalls, I saw Betty Bacall dancing out on the floor. I've known her for years, so I went and started to cut in. She looked at me with considerable scorn and said, Don't you see whom I'm dancing with? And I looked, and it turned out to be Jerry Robbins, whom I'd never met. So I retired, crestfallen. Joan Axelrod says, I remember watching Jerome Robbins and Lauren Bacall doing a fantastic jitterbug together. I remember Truman coming up and whispering that so-and-so was at the ball because his wife had threatened suicide unless they were invited. Running around filling your ear with nonsense like that. I had a whopping good time. Beautiful, full of real gaiety. Marvelous cast of characters. Dr. Russell Maxfield, a friend of Truman, says, I asked Lauren Bacall to dance. Oh boy, she'd just been dancing with Jerry Robbins, a fantastic dancer, and I was kind of embarrassed, but I wanted to dance with her and talk her up a bit. I went to her table and asked her. That was the reason for the mask. You were supposed to be able to ask anyone and they would have to dance with you. She was a perfect lady. She just sat down. I didn't realize she was so exhausted. On the dance floor, she talked about how hot it was and how she was perspiring. We did just a little two-step with the music, and then I took her over and sat her down. We barely got up and down. Christopher Cerf, who will become a television producer, recalls about the night. I was just out of college. I remember dancing with Mia Farrow a lot. That was pretty exciting. I was like, hey, this is me, and look what I'm doing. She seemed to be my age when everybody else was a lot older. I do want to bring in the fact that Ann Woodward did not crash Truman's ball. There was only one particular crasher that night. Her name was Susan Payson Burke. She recalls her story. I was just out of college working in New York. I had gone with a date to some black tie party, and we were having a drink at Trader Vic's in the plaza. We saw these lights and cameras. My date and I looked at each other and I said, what a challenge. In those days, everybody went to everybody's parties. My date was a guy from Texas named Jerry Jones. He took my arm and we walked into the plaza ballroom with a bunch of people and they never checked us. It was fabulous. The first person I saw was Mia Farrow and Frank Sinatra and every other person in the world whose faces I'd seen in the papers. Truman came up, and he was very jovial. Couldn't have been more friendly. He said, I'm so glad you're here, clearly not knowing who I was. I said, yes, it's awfully nice of you. I'm Susan Payson. He said, oh, yes, of course. My date said, I'm Jerry Jones. Oh, yes, Truman said. What are you doing in New York? Jerry said, well, I just finished business school, and I'm working at McKinsey. Truman said, I don't remember where you're sitting, but why don't you come to this table? He introduced us. These are my friends from Kansas. At first, it didn't dawn on me who those people were. Kansas? Yes. And what do you do? One guy said, I'm with the police. I'm a detective. Then, all of a sudden, the light dawned on the two of us. Here we were, smack in the center of Truman's cast of characters from In Cold Blood. It was divine. We stayed until the end. We danced and we had the most marvelous time. Didn't know a soul. It was perfect. I danced with the detectives. I can remember saying, you don't seem to have a gun. The next time I saw Truman was a few years later. I had married. Phyllis and Bennett Cerf were great friends of ours. They had a house nearby, the Columns in Mount Kisco. One Sunday lunch, I reunited with Truman. He kind of looked at me for a couple of hours, and I smiled. Phyllis and Bennett had no idea I'd ever met him before. Finally, at a quiet point, we were all sitting down by the pool. I said, Truman, you looked like you might remember me, but I don't think you really know from where. He said, no. I went on. Actually, I was the only person with my date who managed to crash your party, the famous black and white ball in New York. He said, "No," in that high little voice. I told him this with quite a bit of trepidation, but he thought it was the most wonderful thing. From then on, he would take my hand and say, "This is the person who crashed my party." He was darling. He would do this at parties in New York. Even toward the end, when he wasn't sadly in very great shape, he would always remember me. "This is the girl." Kenneth J. Lane, the famous jewelry designer, recalls, "I remember meeting Tallulah Bankhead for the first and last time at his dance. She looked exactly like Tallulah Bankhead. I was very flattered to have been invited. I had just sort of arrived at the star scene, having made my first bits of jewelry, which all the ladies loved desperately. So I got into Noah's Ark that way." George Plimpton says, "Tallulah Bankhead wore an extraordinary mask made up to look like a great bird of prey. Brendan Gill, who wrote a biography of her, said that she was frightened about going, fearful that no one would talk to her. Instead, she had been startled and very pleased by the number of people who stopped by her table to chat. One of them was a man named Jesse Levy, who curiously was not on the guest list, but was there in the Plaza ballroom nevertheless. After the party, he and a few other guests went back to Tallulah Bankhead's apartment. He must have made quite an impression. According to Brendan Gill, he afterward became her paid steward, secretary, escort, whatever, played the piano for her, cooked her meals, got her in and out of bed, and so forth. So seeing to her needs that when she died, he was left the piano and a quarter of her estate. So at least as far as Tallulah Bankhead was concerned, and indeed Jesse Levy, they must have been very grateful to Truman. On the other hand, perhaps that can't be said of Alice Roosevelt Longworth, Teddy Roosevelt's daughter. She had her townhouse in Washington burgled while she was in the Plaza. She was quite funny about it. Her house was famous for being in disorder. I went there once and remembered a tattered lion skin hanging askew on a wall. The only perfectly ordered thing was a huge dollhouse, everything in it just so. Not at all like the rest of her place. When the police told her house had been ransacked, she asked, "How do they know? It always looked ransacked." Alfred Kazin says, "The last time I was famous was when I was a guest at Truman Capote's Black and White Ball. When someone asked him who I was, Truman kindly said I had written a book called A Walker in the City. And he said, 'I think Alfred's an artist.' An artist or no artist, there I was, looking at Mrs. Joseph P. Kennedy, constantly replacing her makeup, John O'Hara joining in with his friends naming racehorses, and I thought, oh boy, I'm a celebrity." A very young Candace Bergen was also in attendance at the Black and White Ball. Candace Bergen had this to say, "I remember faces, Frank Sinatra and Mia Farrow, Norman Mailer, Douglas Fairbanks Jr. wearing a black executioner's hood, Henry Ford, Christina, and all these extraordinary carnival-like headdresses, some of them birds of prey. I was the new girl in town and wasn't really sure why I'd been invited. I was dressed in a white mink rabbit mask made by Halston. Quite enough to live down for the next 25 years. Of course, at the time, I thought I looked sensational. We had dinner at Carter Burden's under a Francis Bacon painting, one of his screaming cardinals, very likely. I remember the ball being a lot of work. I was quite relieved to get home. I've never been a very good party chatter. The ball was so charged, there was so much freight it carried that it was not a relaxing evening. I never really shared that exalted sense of entitlement that these people enjoyed. You know how those things are. Just a few weeks ago, I was at a ball outside Paris and I felt the same way. It was paralyzingly intimidating to me. And yet everyone was just gliding through. It was so civilized that a man near me leaned forward to a woman standing too close to a candelabra and quite suddenly said, 'I think your hair is on fire.' She said, 'Oh,' she moved away. it was put out, tufts of hair on the floor, but she had never even raised her voice, or anyone else around. In America, we would have screamed, "Oh my God!" Nothing was said. It was all in slow motion. The other thing to remember about Truman's Ball was that it was during Vietnam. I remember the guilt I felt, or actually the guilt the other people thought I should feel. I was 19, I think, when I went to the ball, and I hadn't yet sprouted that kind of consciousness. Reporters going in and out accosted me. Wasn't it inappropriate to have a ball for 400 people when a war was going on? The homeless, starving. What did I say? Oh, honestly, those rabbit ears bobbing. Somebody said, could it have been Douglas Fairbanks in his executioner's hood? The question's inappropriate. Somebody else said, the war's inappropriate. Somebody who was wearing a mouse mask with little ears. It was a question of deflecting guilt. Nowadays, I don't see how anyone can rationalize a gesture like a ball at any point in these times. I only went to that ball outside Paris because they were friends of my husband's family. A bizarre, probably obscene choice. There's something especially decadent about a ball. Norman Potteritz, the editor, said, there was a small episode, almost a fight between Norman Mailer and McGeorge Bundy. I may have introduced them, I'm not sure. Anyway, I was talking to either Bundy or Mailer and the other one came over. Bundy was then at the White House and there were ugly words. I remember Mailer saying to Bundy, I paid you too much respect. He actually, I think, invited Bundy outside. Bundy said something very haughty. He said, Mr. Mailer, I think this is silly and you're childish, or words to that effect. But for the rest, it was great fun and very glamorous, especially if you weren't used to that kind of glamour. This is the second fight that Norman Mailer almost gets into the night of the black and white ball. It's not the only one. Norman Mailer always kind of ready to fight. If you are looking for Norman Mailer's Trashy Divorces Saga, that is over on my sister podcast. If you thought he was perhaps mean and nasty to his friends, you should see what he did to his wives. Norman Mailer will talk about his second altercation of the evening, saying, that night I had an altercation with McGeorge Bundy and invited him outside. We had an argument about Vietnam, and at one point he put his hand on my arm very kindly and said, well, of course, you really don't know much about it. I said, let's go downstairs. I was very brave because he was obviously in better condition than I was. I was dissolute and full of drink. But I'd have killed him that night. I was so angry. One night every 3 years you can win if you're going to have it. That was one of those nights. I had a terrible argument with Lillian Hellman as a result. Because she overheard it, she stopped it. She was always such a celebrity fucker. It must be said of Lillian that when the chips were down, she'd always go for the guy who had the most clout. And there was no doubt in her mind that McGeorge Bundy had a good deal more than I did. So she turned on me right in front of him and said, how dare you, Norman? I said, you get lost. We had this huge fight, like an older sister and her kid brother. Then we didn't speak for a year or two. I wasn't going to speak to her ever again, right in front of McGeorge Bundy. Anyway, Truman's responsible for all of this. Now multiply this by, there are only three of us, 133 in the scenes you got. William F. Buckley Jr. continues about Norman Mailer that night. He was challenging everybody to a fight. A lot of people were pretty lubricated that night, including Norman. In a semi-affectionate way in which we have always contended, he didn't seem that way with me. Put up your dukes, but there was nothing serious about it. John Kenneth Galbraith. It was one of those rare occasions when you knew by sight or by fame or infamy everybody there. What I particularly remember was organizing a musical football game with George Plimpton. It was sort of a mellow dance to the music in which he picked up the ball, passed it to me, I reversed it to him, he ran with it, keeping time to the music. Somebody had come, as I recall, in a mask and a top hat, which he'd left on a table, and we were using the top hat as a football. A grand evening. There's no question about that. Of all the evenings that have disappeared from my memory, this one is distinctive in the way it remains. Jill Fox has another memory. I remember being pushed around in a chair over the ballroom floor by Ken Galbraith, or was it George Plimpton? There was a top hat involved. Was I in a football game? Was I in the backfield? Certainly it was the gayest moment of the evening. Virgil Thompson recalls, I understand Truman told the Plaza people he would be sending his own whiskey and brandy for the party. They said no, you pay the hotel by the drink. Cost him a great deal of money, that party, but it was a good party. They can give a good party at the Plaza. He was a good host. He went around from table to table and would sit with everybody. People had bits of costume on. It was full of celebrities. Not many people give a celebrity party like that privately. That kind of party is usually paid for by some movie company. Here comes Eileen Maley again. She says, there was a wonderful, hectic gaiety about the whole party. Truman was the ringmaster. Kay was having a wonderful time, but I think it was all rather overwhelming for her. It was Truman who was really going all out. He would hop, skip, and jump from table to table and say, aren't we having a wonderful time? Aren't we having the most wonderful time? I love this party. Alan Price Jones, the writer, says, I thought it was one of the more terrible parties I'd ever seen. Everybody tremendously got up in mundane masks and television cameras flashing. You couldn't get into the Plaza. The whole of New York was concerned with who was asked and who wasn't. And why weren't certain people? When you actually got there, there really wasn't a party. It never got off the ground at all. I left with Marianne Moore around midnight. We wondered what we were doing standing in this enormous crowd with nothing to eat, nothing to drink, no way of getting on the floor, and everybody by then rather tired of their masks. Herb Cain says, about midnight, Sinatra was having a bad time. He was with Mia. He said, hey, let's get out of here. So we were sneaking out the door to go to one of his joints, Jilly's, that awful bar that he used to hang out in. Truman caught us at the door and tried to put a body block on us. I said, no, we're leaving, but we'll come back. He said, no, you won't. You won't come back. I know you won't come back. Well, we didn't, and I think he was hurt. It was one of those great parties that never got off the ground. People did what they always do, getting up and going into their little cliques and corners. If you're not part of the group, we being from the West Coast, we got that who's that look most of the time. Sinatra just hated the whole thing. Mia Farrow follows this up. We went somewhere else afterward. Jilly's for some chow mein. Now, can you imagine, just me chiming back in here, Dominic Dunn gets the update from his friends who were at the party, from the press, from the society columns, and hears that Frank left that party early, that Truman Capote chose Frank Sinatra and Mia Farrow over Dominic Dunn and his wife Lenny, and they had the nerve to leave the party 2 hours after it started. Oh, I bet our man Nick wasn't pleased about that. Kenneth J. Lane, jewelry designer, and really like BFFs with Eileen Maley, says this, there are few parties here with a late supper, breakfast really. It's not an American policy. It's more like a European ball. It's a nice break. It keeps people on, greedy for that sausage. Anyway, Benedetta Barzini and I were having breakfast together. She was a model then and very, very beautiful. She was wearing a necklace of mine as a mask and looking through the holes. Sam Spiegel came up, seeing this ravishing creature, and asked to be introduced. I said, Sam, do you know Benedetta? She just got up and turned on her heel to walk away. He watched after her and asked, what's the matter with that girl? What's wrong with her? I had no idea, but later I asked her, why were you so awful to Sam Spiegel? She said, when I first came to America, my father gave me 2 letters to old friends. The first person I went to see was Mr. Spiegel. When I went to see him, he tried to seduce me. I was 17. He doesn't remember. So that was it. Sam had tried to pounce. The next day, he called me and asked, "Did you ever find out?" I said, "Well, you know who she is, Sam. Her name's Benedetta Barzini, and her father is Luigi. I think you've met her before." Sam said, "I'll talk to you soon." Lewis Lapham, the editor, says, "I passed through the police barricades in front of the plaza and listened to Pete Hamill, among others, shouting at me that this is the beginning of the end, that the tumbrils will soon be rolling." He was then a New York Post reporter, and he was speaking for the sans-culottes that this was all too brash and arrogant, a display of wealth and celebrity, and it was being thrown in the teeth of the Democrats in the streets and so forth. I remember the evening being extraordinary for one reason. At most New York parties, there's always a degree of anxiety. It was good to be there, but was one at the right table, or was one being seen at the right end of the room or with the right people? But on this occasion, every table was the right table. Simply to be present was to be, for the time being, safe on the high and sunny plateau. So all the tables were equally fine, and everybody was just pleased to be present. Then I noticed this extraordinarily beautiful woman, whom I later found out was Luciana Pinatelli. She had some sort of career as an Italian model, or was somehow associated with the Italian haute monde. Clearly she had that manner. I remember she was wearing this immense jewel, an emerald or a ruby, possibly a diamond, in the middle of her head. She wore a kind of head ribbon, and in the center of it was this great stone. I don't know whether it had come from India or once been worn by an elephant or the Tsarina of Russia, but it was clearly a stone that had a history. Empires had perished. Many had died in order to provide this brilliance for the head of Luciana Pinatelli. I noticed that every time she moved or danced or glittered in the light, about three guys were standing around, whose eyes never left her forehead. She had more security than any of the Kennedys present. Apparently, she had borrowed this jewel from Harry Winston, and Winston had let it out of his sight only on the condition that it was followed by three heavies with guns. At the end of the party, Gianni Agnelli wanted to go someplace and play poker. It was 2 a.m. One of the places to play poker at that hour was Elaine's. Among the cognoscenti, or the friends of Gianni, as they were known, someone had suggested, "Why don't we all go to Elaine's and play cards?" Somehow, I ended up in the same limousine with Luciana, who was part of this entourage. She was not wearing the jewel. The guards had removed this thing from her forehead. I may be exaggerating. Maybe she went tastefully into the ladies' room, put it into a portable safe, and presented it to the guards that way in a lead-lined casket. In any case, the jewel did not get into the car, it didn't get out of the hotel, and it never graced Elaine's. Peter Duchin, the band leader, recalls, "The remarkable thing to me was seeing these legendary people you just didn't see out in public much, dancing at 4 o'clock in the morning. The Jock Whitneys, the Paleys, people like that you just never expected to see dancing late at night. And they did have a heck of a good time." Denise Boucher, "I liked the way he stood with Kay at the end of the evening to say goodnight to his guests. Good evening," he said to everyone. Dr. Russell Maxfield recalled, "Those of us from Kansas were the first to arrive at the ball and the last to leave. In fact, there was hardly anyone left in the ballroom but us. Just then, a large number of people came back and started wandering around, peering down at the floor. It turned out this lady had lost a huge pearl that had fallen off of one of her dancing pumps. We all got out there and looked for it. The last people there in a big search party. We finally found it, this immense pearl. When we went back up to our rooms in the plaza, Truman joined us. He was just so excited, he wanted to talk all night." Joan Axelrod is going to take us out of this bit of what happened at the ball. She says, "There had been a late supper, then there was breakfast. I had stayed for the lot, scrambled eggs with caviar and smoked salmon. In retrospect, I would feel very superstitious about giving myself a party like that. It's like putting a period on the sentence. It's spooky to say, here I am in all my splendor. All right, friends, we're going to take another quick break here. Fill in a few ads from our sponsors. When we come back, we are going to talk about what is remembered after the ball. What are the reminiscences of this 1966 event? See you on the flip. All right, friends, in this episode, we have talked about the before the ball, the middle of the ball, during the ball. What are the reminiscences of the ball? From John Sargent, the publisher. In my diary, I have this curious poem. I have no idea whose it is, it just sits there. Truman Capote is not nearly as dotty as some of the people who went to his party. Goodness. Joel Schumacher recalls, the ball reminds me of those incredible drawings from Thackeray's Vanity Fair, illustrations of the rich, unconscious people getting dressed up and dancing on the edge of the abyss with skeletons. It was like the barbecue at the Wilkes's at the beginning of Gone with the Wind, all those people playing out this thing while the Civil War was happening under their noses. That's the sort of thing Truman's ball really represents. It has no other significance. Nothing happened at this party except all the people who knew each other pretended to kiss each other on both cheeks because they didn't want to smear their makeup or have to readjust their masks. Norman Potteritz recalls, I was not just astonished but flabbergasted by the way the world responded to that party. It was the first such party, at least to my knowledge, publicized that intensely. The guest list was published in the New York Times. I don't remember any party before or since treated that way by the Times, except for possibly state dinners at the White House. I discovered afterward that virtually everywhere I went, people knew that I had been at the party and were either envious or affected to be contemptuous. And I stress the word affected. I was at Yaddo not long after the party, and that's all anybody would talk about in my presence. Whoever decided to give it that kind of coverage, the Times Society editor, I just don't know, but whoever did it sensed, and maybe quite accurately, that this party represented some turning point in the cultural history, the social history of New York, even the United States, in the sense that the confluence of the fashionable societal world and the literary world and the world of political power was embodied in that guest list. Those are the worlds that in this country, say, in contrast with England or France, have always been separate and have rarely been intersected. One reason for that is the United States, as others have observed, is unusual in having its political capital in a different city from its cultural capital. London, Paris, or pre-World War II Berlin or Vienna, all great European countries, had the cultural center and the political capital in the same place. Here in America, starting with the Kennedy years, the split was being bridged. I think Truman had a very shrewd sense of this kind of process and was himself very much in the center of it. In effect, he dramatized the change by making that party's guest of honor a Washington figure, Kay Graham. Louis Auchincloss, lawyer, novelist, and Auchincloss family member, said, I had a client, now long deceased, who was going to another law firm. When she read that I was at the party, she decided to stay with me a little longer. We wouldn't be done without a little bit more from Norman Mailer. He says, Women's Wear Daily gave me the award for worst dressed man at Truman's ball. I was wearing a dirty gabardine raincoat with my black tie. Also, you got in like half a dozen fights, Norman Mailer. He'll continue. But I have good memories of the ball. It was one of the best parties I ever went to. So much action. So many people of a sort you'd never met before. For example, there was Tallulah Bankhead. For 20 years, she'd been enjoying the coup her public relations man had given her when, as legend had it, she said to me, Oh, you're the young man who doesn't know how to spell fuck. For those who are too young to know, it was because I had used Fug, F-U-G, in The Naked and the Dead. Of course we'd never met. For me, it was like a burr under a saddle. Of course I blew the opportunity to tell her off. She looked too attractive and, big surprise, too vulnerable. Well, that's probably the only person you didn't fight with, Norman Mailer. He'll finish up here. It's probably hyperbole to say that everything there felt anointed that night. Truman had certainly brought it off. It certainly was his greatest coup. For some, and I might be one of them, that party was even greater than any particular one of his books. Peter Duchin will say the Venice Ball's extremely beautiful. The Save the Venice Ball all candlelit, and you came off the water in gondolas and walked into the large room where the band was playing. The Paleys gave a party for their daughter Kate where the dance floor was painted aubergine. Extraordinary. But Truman's really ranks way up there, no question. Joan Axelrod says, it's hard to compare. My idea of a great party is having entertainment, people sitting down at the piano. We had a great old time at the Gershwins. Oscar Levant, Judy Garland, she used to tell stories. Wonderful rock on tour. Endless old vaudeville jokes that took forever to get off the ground and put everyone on the floor. Harold Arlen at the piano playing a new score. Or Julie Stein. The Surfs gave wonderful parties. So did Frank Sinatra. There was always a lot of entertaining going on. What does every old lady in the world say? They don't make them like they used to. Those parties don't exist now. People just go in and snort their coke or sit and look at the movies. Just a few more comments here, Joel Schumacher again. There are a lot of people who can get by in life by having the talent to amuse. I certainly can't criticize that. If you can better your lifestyle, your position, by being someone whom people like to have around because you amuse them, and you can live with it on your own terms, then fine. But we're talking about a great American writer. All those years to have gone by, and for so little to have emerged. A lot of that has to do with the experience he was having, being treated like a Pekingese, sitting on needlepoint pillows for everybody to say how darling, how bitchy. It's hard for any artist of integrity to have self-respect. I think the ball, in many ways, was the beginning of the end. The celebrity ball took precedence over his own craft. Joe Petrasek says this, the year before he died, he began talking about doing another ball. It was just one of his little pipe dreams, but he talked about it frequently. He was going to give it in Paraguay. He was absolutely convinced that everybody he'd want to invite had never been to that place and that they'd come. The invitation read something like, Don Senor Truman Capote requests the pleasure of your company for a masked ball. Place, a palace in Asunción, Paraguay. Dress, a Paraguayan aristocrat circa 1860. Masks until midnight. He went on and on about it. Jason Epstein, the writer and editor, is going to close us down with this final comment. I had fun at it. I wouldn't mind going again if only somebody would ask me. I have to say that I would not have turned down an invitation either. Oh, that, my investigators, is the real what happened at the Black and White Ball, the before, the during, and the after. Thank you, one and all, for joining me for today's episode. 1966, we've traveled there from the folks that lived it. I appreciate you spending your time with me, for telling your friends about Done and Done, for your kind reviews, for your emails, for your support on Patreon. Patreon friends, don't forget, be sure to check your Not Done Yet feed. We are covering the very long and detailed, ridiculously spiderweb-filled story this week of Eileen Mailey, Susie Knickerbocker. Y'all are really going to like that one. We will be back next time, continuing to swim with the swans over here on the main feed. With many thanks and much love to all of you. Until we meet again, friends, stay curious and keep on investigating. Thanks for listening to the Dun & Dun podcast, a Hemlock Creatives production. You can email us at dunanddun@gmail.com. You can follow us on Instagram at Dun & Dun Podcast. For further information about our episodes or sources, you can find us online at www.dunanddun.com. See you next week, friends.